It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope that it's successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in cultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. I am incredibly pleased today to welcome Professor Thomas F. Thornton and Professor Madonna L. Moss to the show. Professor Thornton is Professor of Environment and Society at the University of Alaska Southeast. He is also the author of Being in Place Among the Tlingit. Professor Moss is Professor of Anthropology and Curator of Zooarchaeology at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History at the University of Oregon. She is also the author of Northwest Coast, Archaeology as Deep History. Today, we are discussing their new book, Herring and People of the North Pacific, Sustaining a Keystone Species, which was published in 2021 by the University of Washington Press. Professor Thornton, Professor Moss, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Adam.
Could you speak to the background of the book a little bit?
Yeah, I guess I can begin. The background to the book was really I would classify it as a problem-based study that we were, invited to do, maybe indirectly by the Tlingit people, particularly of Sitka Sound and Sitka, Alaska, who have been struggling with the management of herring fisheries in their territory, which we call Sitka Kwan. And basically, they have been harvesting herring eggs there for subsistence uses since, we say, time immemorial. But at various times in the colonial history, if you want to call it that, there has been intensive fishing, first in what we call the reduction era, when herring was caught and reduced to oil for feed and fertilizer and so forth. And then in the contemporary era, in what's called the sacro fishery, which is essentially an export fishery of the herring eggs when they're in the sack of roe. So you have to kill the herring in order to extract that. And that's been done very intensively in recent years in Sitka Sound. And they've been very vocal against it for the most part. And in describing why they were against it, they were saying things that were, to me, very clear hypotheses about the decline of herring, that the extent of spawning has declined, the duration of spawning has declined, the size of herring spawners has been reduced, and the quality of spawn has also declined. And so these were things that I thought could be tested, and maybe if we took a long-term view, what we sometimes call a historical ecological view, we could answer these questions and give a better perspective to management about just what's happened with herring, because you have to understand that Alaska is a young state. Its management is fairly shallow. It only goes back to 1960, and that was really, not even full management. It took a while to kind of gear up. And what we would call the local and traditional knowledge in Native communities as well as non-Native communities can stretch back much farther than that. And so But I invited Madonna and her colleagues, Virginia Butler, and we had a couple of graduate students also on the project to help expand that long-term view even beyond the consciousness and memories of living people. And so the project was called Herring Synthesis, and it was funded by the North Pacific Research Board. We carried out a regional study, so tried to touch on all of the major traditional herring gathering communities in Southeast Alaska. And that was started and was done between 2006 or 7 rather, and about 2010 when the final draft was published. But I'll let Madonna say a little bit more about her origins in the project.
Thanks. I think that, you know, I said that I'd started working in Southeast Alaska in 1978. And while that's true, it wasn't really until the mid 80s that I became more clearly aware of the importance of herring to Tlingit fishers. And that's because in the course of my dissertation research, I was using fine screens to sieve archaeological deposits. And I looked at 8 different sites, and people in the communities where I worked were really not very enthusiastic about archaeological research. They didn't want to see disturbance of archaeological sites. So my approach was to take very small samples and to analyze them intensively. And when people in the community of Angoon, where I worked, saw what I was doing with these soil samples and midden samples, it helped allay their concerns. They could see that I wasn't really collecting very many artifacts, but I was going through the food remains, that is the shell and bone that are found in these archaeological sites. And I put them over 2-millimeter mesh screens. And it was then that you start to see the small bones that aren't recovered in a typical excavation, or it wasn't typical at that time. So if you're just excavating with a trowel, you're not going to see herring bones. If you're just screening with 1/8-inch mesh, you're not necessarily going to recover many herring bones. But when you're taking bulk samples and you're recovering you're using very fine screens, that's when you start to see the herring bones. And so I was impressed by the herring bones that were present in the site. And particularly, there was one site near Angoon that had mostly herring bones. And that was somewhat of a surprise to me. And then over time, I got more interested in understanding the importance of this forage fish, which had been largely left out of archaeological treatments, not just of Southeast Alaska, but of the Northwest coast more generally. Over the years, and in particular working in Sitka, you learn from people that you're working with is that they care about a lot of things about their culture and history, but they really do care a lot about herring. And it seemed to me that it was important to use what archaeological collections we had to study the herring more intensively, and not necessarily go out and dig large portions of archaeological sites, but to work with the collections we had and to study herring bones. And I can say more about that later.
What audience did you have in mind for this book?
I think for me, part of the audience was Tlingit people themselves, you know, and trying to reflect back a lot of the things that I've been told in the course of this herring synthesis project, as well as others who worked on the project and separately in other contexts. And to try to paint a holistic, integrated picture of the role of herring in the marine socio-ecological system, if you will, because we don't tend to think of it that way. We tend to think of herring as resources, but that's not really the way that indigenous people have thought about herring. And we tend to think about Northwest Coast peoples as, you know, complex or high-level hunter-gatherer fishers, but actually when it comes to things like herring and clam we've talked about clam gardens and other things these days, we recognize that there's a significant degree of cultivation that goes on to produce the distribution and abundance of resources that we have in Southeast Alaska. And, you know, to the extent that the managers of these resources are basically not aware of that, they are also an audience for this book, because it's trying to present a different way of looking at herring, a different way of valuing herring, and also to tell another story about the development of Alaska and of the North Pacific as a region in terms of its most important forage fish. And I don't know about you, but I've always been captivated by those micro histories, you know, books with titles like Cod and Salt or whatever, that are trying to tell the history of the world through a specific resource. And, you know, when I read Cod, one of my reactions was, well, what do cod eat? Cod eat herring. So really, we should go one level down. And that's where the story begins. And I guess to write the real history of our marine environments, we'd have to get down to the plankton level. And somebody's going to write the history of plankton. But herring are just really important. And so the book is really a tight focus on indigenous cultures of Southeast Alaska in some ways. But at another level, it's trying to look at the North Pacific as a region and even compare hemispheres, you know, because we talk about Atlantic herring and some of the same problems we see in the Pacific are actually evident in the Atlantic, and, you know, during the Little Ice Age, so that much further. And so we need to learn from these historical examples, but we also need to understand herring, I would say, in this anthropological context, which is, the long durée, the long period of time that relationships have developed between people and herring, and all the ways that they are culturally significant, not just as a food, you know, in terms of pounds, you know, consumed, but also as a shared resource that creates conviviality, I call it in the book, and goodwill, you know, it's kind of a first fruit in the spring, if you will. I'd say it's our Easter eggs, because after all, rabbits don't lay eggs, but herring do. And they're, of course, very, very widely distributed, especially from Sitka Sound. 87% of the eggs that are harvested are distributed, either exchanged or given away, most of them given away by the harvesters who gather them. So, you know, that's extraordinary in itself. And most people are not aware of this. You know, we have lots of books about salmon. We don't have that many about herring. We don't have any herring museums in Alaska. You know, there's just not a lot of attention paid to it. It's kind of taken for granted, but not among indigenous people, because they've been out there fighting for herring really since the beginning of the 20th century, when they began to be overfished commercially. So we thought that's an important story to tell.
Well, and I think that placing it within the larger North Pacific context and looking at Japan and Russia and looking at the relationships that people in that area have had with herring and how the overexploitation of herring really started there earlier helps bring context to what happens in the Northeast Pacific along our Northwest coast. And I think in terms of audience, one of the things that characterizes Tom's work, much of his work, is his ability to draw in Native voices. Tlingit voices are very much present in this book. And so I know I felt really strongly that after we'd finished the herring synthesis project, I felt strongly that those voices needed to be preserved for a larger audience. Not that many people are going to download a 650-page PDF from the North Pacific Research Board, you know, and read it. But these voices are testimony to environmental change that has happened within people's lives. And they bring so much authority. And Tom's work has been characterized by this for a very long time. And so I felt strongly that they needed to be preserved in a book. And so, you know, I don't know when we started talking about it, Tom, but the need to bring the book to publication that would have a wider audience. So we wanted more people to hear these voices. And also, I wanted the opportunity to incorporate the archaeological record because it does provide this long-term historical ecological record that is not duplicated anywhere else. And so I wanted to be able to share that with a larger audience as well. And I think that, maybe parts of the archaeological record are kind of boring because they're so place-based and you need to know a lot of local names to really appreciate them. On the other hand, I felt like this book really did provide a synthesis in a way that we were not able to do in the Herring Synthesis Project. I felt like we were more synthetic, more holistic. We brought things together in a more coherent, comprehensive way in this book. And so I feel like it is the, it better achieves the goal of Herring Synthesis.
Why are herring important?
So I'm just going to note that Madonna's letting me go first. I'm not stealing the stage after each one of these questions. But one answer to that is in the title, the word keystone species. And we use the terms foundation species and cultural keystone species because keystone species in biology is slightly different than in using the term cultural keystone species. But cultural keystone species just means it's very important within a cultural setting and is a resource that about which there's a lot of knowledge. There's typically a lot of ceremony. There's a lot of exchange. There's a plethora of linguistic terms, often very specific to the life cycle and habits of that species that makes it important. And the word foundation is also a very good term because it simply means that the rest of what you're talking about, in our case, the marine ecosystem, the food web that's so important to so many creatures that we value in the Pacific Northwest is highly dependent as a foundation on herring. And herring are incredible converters of bioenergetics, if you will, in eating the smallest critters, the zooplankton and other critters, and turning that into, lots and lots of oily, nutritious flesh and bone and so forth for critters higher up the food web. And that's why they're important to protect, and that's why it's important to have a lot of them. So, and sometimes people don't understand that because you say, "Oh, I see a lot of herring, out there at this time," but actually, that's a symptom of maybe not understanding how much we've lost historically. Something called shifting baseline syndrome, but. But anyway, those are two reasons why they're important. They're cultural keystone species, and they're biologically a foundation species. And then I think a third reason why they're very important is that they're we use the term bellwether. They're really an indicator for the health of our marine systems, which is an indicator of the health of our coastal economies, really, which are built on fish and shellfish and other resources. So we should be paying attention to them and maybe not treating them just like any other fish or any other resource.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that because it was very comprehensive, Tom. But I would say something along the lines of they're so interconnected to so many different species that, despite the focus, and it might appear that we're focusing on a single fish, and we are, but it's so interconnected to the whole marine system that it is the health of the whole system that we're concerned with. And it can all break down if the herring aren't protected.
And Professor Moss has already touched on this. Could you talk about some of the people you worked with?
Yeah, I mean, that's the most fun thing about being a cultural anthropologist is you work with, you work a lot with people, and of course archaeologists too, and I know McDonough does a lot of public and consultative archaeology, which involves contemporary groups of people. And it's very, very important. And the study was designed to have a focus on all of the local and traditional knowledge. And so a lot of it is indigenous knowledge, but not all of it. And so I might start by by emphasizing a couple of the surprises that I ran into. And one of them is in Ketchikan, which is a city, and it has a conservative, I would say, long-term resident, non-native population in many ways. They don't want to be identified as conservationists and would be called names like that. But they were extremely concerned about herring. And a lot of traditional and local knowledge about herring that had been passed down through generations, in some cases, in non-native families, and a lot of consulting about what's going on with herring between the native and non-native community, especially long-term, long-term residents of that area and what they'd seen, and so taking that community perspective and not just focusing in on a segment of the population, I think was very interesting to me. And so a lot of the people who you'd say might be right of Attila the Hun on the political spectrum are really upset about what's happened to herring. And some of them are fishermen who make their living on salmon and have seen what's happened to salmon as a result of herring being overfished. We met a wide range of people in our discussions, and then, we weren't necessarily just focused on elders. So we were dealing with younger people as well, gender wise, there were many people, on both genders who were contributing knowledge. But I would say, one of the most remarkable people we talked to is Dr. Walter Sobolov, who is considered kind of revered statewide as a cultural leader and lived to be, I think, 101 years old. And we interviewed him for this project, and it was very interesting because he was actually employed in Angoon, a little community in central southeast Alaska, at the first ever herring reduction plant, which was on Killis New Island. And he was working there when he was, in his teens, which was in the prior to 1920. And he was, we were asking him, when they were fishing herring commercially, how soon did it take before they had to really go very far from where they had originally gotten the herring? In other words, at what point did the local supply become unsustainable? And he was able to tell us firsthand, because this wasn't recorded elsewhere, that already by the time he was working there, in say 1920s, they had shifted way down to the end of Admiralty Island, which is, 50, 60, 70 miles away to fish, because they kind of fished out that area. And that was really the first plant in southeast Alaska. And then after World War I, you had a bunch of other plants. So I think it went up to almost 20 that were in the region fishing, industrially for herring and taking large quantities. So, despite all of that, he was actually optimistic about herring in the future, because he thought if we understood their value and we took care of them, as it seemed like we were starting to do with studies like this, he said, that they will come back, because they are very, very resilient. And they do come back, but sometimes it takes a long time, and you have to have that proper habitat for them to return. So that was a very interesting interview there, because it really crystallized what traditional knowledge could tell you and longevity in a place could tell you that just wasn't available in the historical records.
I would just add that I also found it's really compelling to hear people in both Ketchikan and Sitka talk about how when the pulp mills closed down, how water quality improved. I mean, it took time, but there's descriptions in the book of the quality of the water in Ketchikan and Sitka, and just being filled with contaminants. And I think that if you live in Southeast Alaska, you have this sense of this pristine area with the rain and the mountains and the forests, and And these localized sources of pollution were really damaging to the herring, and hearing people talk about that and appreciating what it's meant that the pulp mills have closed down was also very compelling. Well, there are a lot of stories that are, we hope that they're compelling to our readers. But those are the kinds of things that, you know, first person testimony of how change has happened in the 20th century. I think that these voices are really a strength of the book. Or one of the strengths of the book.
As a reader, I can assure you the stories are extremely compelling.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Thanks, Adam.
In the introduction, you list four tragedies, however. The tragedy of the commons, the tragedy of commodification, the tragedy of monoculture, and the tragedy of what you call conviviality. Could you talk about these and how they fit in with current fishing practices and policies?
Yeah, I can start on that. That's certainly a big topic, but a lot of people see fisheries management as one of really dealing with the tragedy of the commons, in the sense that if you don't, you know, have territories at sea and you have lots of people that can jump in there and fish, you end up with this case of it's in no one's interest to not take some more if the next person just will come and vacuum them up or fish them out. And so that, you know, in a nutshell, as Garrett Hardin identified back in the 60s, is the so-called tragedy of the commons. And a lot of our fisheries management has developed to eliminate that problem. But I think it stems from maybe a misunderstanding of all that's behind it, because the typical way of dealing with it is to privatize access to the fishery through a permit system, often transferable on a market basis. And that's not necessarily the best way to handle a public good like herring, which are very, very abundant, widespread, and provide value for a whole range of people while they're in the water, not just after they're fished and processed and so forth. And so that second tragedy, I would call the tragedy of commodification, right? Which is when you commodify a resource and commercialize it and start to measure it in terms of ex vessel value and everything else, you tend to become myopic on those values and trying to extract as much as you possibly can for that value, and you neglect the other values, which are not as John Muir said, not dollarable, right? He said everything, nothing dollarable is safe. And that's still a pretty good maxim to describe what's going on in fisheries, as he was talking about forestry in particular. But that issue is really the tragedy of commodification. And then the third one of monoculture is really just not looking at the whole system, right? So if we really think about how can we have more herring, how can we extract more herring, you know, pretty soon you're going to end up with herring farms or something like that, right? We're going to take over the whole life cycle and genetically grow them or whatever. And, you know, that kind of monocultural approach has generally not been successful for rebuilding our natural systems, which have a whole host of other values besides food production or producing dollars. So, you know, we have to avoid that. And the system we characterize as maximum sustained yield tends to focus on that, on those dollarable values and on, you know, maximizing extraction of single species fish populations that are of value. And then the last one is the tragedy of conviviality is what happens to a resource like herring, which is celebrated for its abundance and shared so widely for its abundance, particularly among native people, so much so that almost nobody eats herring eggs alone. You know, in other words, it's not kind of right or proper to be eating herring eggs alone. You always eat them with other people. And I don't know how many times it's been described of people come back and they spread out newspaper on the kitchen table and they put down their herring eggs on branches after they've been blanched, slightly boiled, and you know, everybody comes over and you eat, and that's what we mean by conviviality. And you know, that's a value that is not captured in fisheries economics, but it's very, very important, to Indigenous people and even to some non-Indigenous communities that consume things like herring eggs. And so, you know, that's also lost. And if you reduce the number of people who can participate in the fishery because, you know, the eggs or the herring become less reliable, less accessible, and so forth, you're really impacting that conviviality because you're relying on just a very few people who have to work very, very hard to even get the resource out there and distributed. And that's unfortunately the situation we face now, where there aren't as many harvesters of herring eggs as there used to be, because it takes more time. You got to have a boat. You have to be able to search around and find out where they are. And then to distribute them, you have to usually have some of your own capital. You got to go to Alaska Airlines and ship out some 50-pound boxes, you know, to your friends, your neighbors upstate, wherever. And so, you know, that's a big burden to carry for just fewer people who have access to that resource and have increased cost to get it. So that too is a tragedy that fits under that conviviality banner.
I would only add that I know that it's hard to draw analogies, but in the spring, if you're lucky enough to be in Sitka when the herring come in, there's just a special excitement that happens. And perhaps it's like a holiday like Christmas. You know, people think about the excitement of Christmas and looking forward to it. And our Christmas comes at the same time every year. The herring don't necessarily come exactly the same day. You don't know when specifically they're going to come, but when they come, it's a real celebration and people are very excited and they work together to find the herring, to gather the herring, to process the herring. And so when people get together and eat herring in the spring, there's just this special celebratory seasonal feeling that happens. And it's also a time when, just like another holiday, like Easter or Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever, elders can recall the past and tell stories about those special times, those special days. What was it like when I was young and I did this? So it's that seasonal celebratory spirit is very special, what happens in late March, early April in places like Sitka. And then if herring are frozen and they come out for other community celebrations, again, it evokes that special time in the spring. So it's the end of a long winter. It's the end of the darkest times during the year. The days are getting longer. I mean, it's so exciting to be there for spring in Southeast Alaska when the herring arrive. So that is part of the conviviality part of it as well, I think.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In the book, you repeatedly, and you've already alluded to this a little bit, you repeatedly discuss shifting baseline syndrome. Could you elaborate on that for listeners?
Yeah, shifting baseline syndrome is something that was identified by the fisheries biologist Daniel Pauly as a kind of amnesia that develops among fisheries managers because you actually don't have a historical depth of consciousness or of data in some cases to know how much has been lost when you, say, start your management regime that gives you data from a certain standpoint. And so, you know, when you read the historical descriptions of herring in Southeast Alaska, you know, people say it used to go for miles and miles. They talk about the sound of herring at night when they would rise to the surface as being like a rainstorm or a big wind rustling, you know, and they all talk about these as being, you know, phenomena in the past tense, right? It's not there anymore. But because it's not sort of quantified in the way that we quantify herring today, where by estimating their biomass, you know, in any given management area, it's hard to sort of understand just how much has been lost. And so what we tend to do is we ignore that sort of, say, more abundant historical baseline, and then we deal with the baseline that we can understand through our model, through our data gathering protocol or whatever, and then we compare our performance against that. So at the commercial fishery level, that's what happened. And so the, you know, the state in its management really starts, as I said, not till really the 1960s or 1970s even. And the reduction era had already depleted herring very, very significantly prior to that time. And we have to go back and try to reconstruct and figure out just how much was lost. And that was actually part of what the herring synthesis project was about. And then some people will say things like, well, it was never that abundant there in the first place, or they'll say that herring always fluctuate, you know, they go this way and they go that way. But actually in the oral historical record, and I think Madonna can speak to the archaeological record, that's not necessarily what we find. And so I'm sure there were fluctuations, but the fluctuations were probably between, you know, what seemed like an infinite amount and then, a hell of a lot, you know, so it wasn't between, you know, a lot and not enough, which is what we have now. So that baseline has clearly shifted, but we don't necessarily have a handle on what just how big the historical abundance was, and or even the distribution for that matter. And so that, I think doing this study gave us a better understanding of that, that's proven to be important. And you see the shifting baseline syndrome, and the best photographs are of the, like the trophy fishermen down on Key West or something. You know, if you get the shots 30 years ago, the fish are about 50% bigger than they are, you know, maybe 10 years ago, and then now they're even smaller. So again, what we think of as a trophy fish in our photos, you know, from sport fishing has shifted as the baseline has shifted. But we're talking about, in our case, population, spawning population baselines for herring.
So what we can add from the archaeological record is the geographic extent of herring abundance, which is rather interesting, because today we have a herring in Sitka and Craig and maybe a few other places they show up. But if you look at the archaeological record going back, it goes back 10,000 years. There are herring bones that are over 10,000 years old in some archaeological sites. Not a lot, but there are some. If you go back 4,000 years, 2,000 years, you look at the record geographically and you see that if the archaeologist used fine mesh sieves, then herring are in about 80% of the archaeological sites spread out across Southeast Alaska. So where they're somewhat localized today, they were much more geographically abundant, widespread in the past. And so that is very significant. And then if we look at Southeast Alaska amid the larger Northwest coast, and I've done so with Ian McKechnie, who is at the University of Victoria, we compiled records from the Northwest coast more generally beyond Southeast Alaska. And again, if you look at the geographic record, herring are abundant throughout the region. In fact, they, along with salmon, they are the most ubiquitous fish on the Northwest coast, representing in archaeological sites that use sufficiently small screens to find them. And in looking through time, which Ian and I did, over time, we did not see fluctuations in abundance. And of course, archaeological sites are not year-to-year records. We have longer periods of time that are lumped. We don't have the precision that you would have with a yearly record. But on the other hand, we just don't see those fluctuations. So as Tom just said, we're talking about superabundance and superabundance being part of the long-term history of this region.
So Professor Thornton already mentioned this. In the book, you suggest that policymakers shift from maximum sustainable yield to an ecosystem-based approach. What does that mean?
It means embracing the complexity and the uncertainty that we face in the North Pacific, which is very much affected by climate change, very much affected by development, very much affected by changes in predator-prey relationships with fish like herring. And so if you focus only on the single species productivity of that a single species like herring, it's a maybe an okay way to do it. I mean, the MSY, maximum sustainable yield, as a fisheries paradigm has been heavily indicted by lots of people that have picked holes in it. And there's a wonderful book by Carmel Finley showing that it, in fact, has very dubious origins as a scientific concept, more of a political concept to kind of push our way into South American waters and fish there. Once we got refrigeration and could preserve the fish and bring it back, we sort of wanted to convince the South Americans that they were underfishing their waters, and that this was, you know, wasteful and could actually hurt productivity, not to mention economics. So that, if that sounds dubious, it was, and because it wasn't really based on any evidence. But I don't want to say that maximum sustained yield isn't that way now. But it really only works if you've got a stable environment, and you know, to use a broader term, you know, we lived in the Holocene for a long time, right, with certain stability. But now in this era of dramatic, even catastrophic climate change and what we call the Anthropocene, that stability doesn't exist. And we're seeing this in our salmon populations and in other fisheries. So they're shifting, they're adapting or not adapting. And this is having a profound effect in creating lots of uncertainty. So if you're just going to say, let's take the deposition of eggs that we found last year, and let's use a model based on that and what we see this year in terms of miles of spawn or whatever, and let's gin up a theoretical biomass for next year. With all the uncertainty and all the change that's going on, that's become less viable of a model. It doesn't predict as well the biomass. They've missed it by miles and miles in certain areas, and the fishery wasn't even able to open, the commercial fishery, and subsistence users were also adversely affected. So the only way to deal with such a system then is to embrace an ecosystem-based management approach, because then you're looking at a much wider range of factors, and you may still need to determine a sustainable yield within that, but you're doing it in a much more rich and complex modeling and data gathering that represents the real complexities and dynamism of the environment you live in. So I don't know why it's not embraced. It's obviously a cost to shift how you manage anything, you know, from one system to another. But, you know, all of the signs on the MSY model that have been used in Southeast Alaska are really that it's not working very well. I mean, we're down to Sitka Sound itself. And as I said, they're missing sometimes such that they can't even open the fishery when they predicted, you know, they'd have a harvest of 20,000 tons or whatever. British Columbia is now shifting away from this paradigm, or at least a more precautionary one. So, you know, it will take investment to do it, but I think we have no choice, because the MSY model just doesn't seem to work unless it's very, very conservative. And that's not how it's been applied in Alaska and most of British Columbia, and actually the rest of the North Pacific either.
You end the book with a series of recommendations. Could you mention just a few of these recommendations?
Well, I think one of them was to is to shift to that ecosystem management approach. But I think more broadly, we talk about valuation, valuing herring correctly. And in order to do that, you really need to understand not just their market value, but their value within an ecosystem as a provider of what we call ecosystem services. You know, the fact that they provision lots of other species that we depend on, salmon, native communities would be seals, seabirds, things like that. All of those things are important to us, but we don't necessarily value correctly or at all herring's contributions to those other assets that we rely upon, or services that we rely upon. So herring are undervalued. So correcting that valuation. Restoration is another set of recommendations. And really, I think one of the keys to restoration is looking at the indigenous knowledge. The oral historical record and the historical record are clear that that Tlingit people, at least in Southeast Alaska, and Haida people in Southeast Alaska, have transplanted herring eggs and rebuilt stocks, created new herring spawning areas, and made them reliable and sustainable through their what we call cultivation techniques. Those techniques are not only sustainable for harvesting, gathering herring eggs, but they're also very potentially useful for trying to restore herring into areas where they've been overfished or have left because of habitat degradation and so forth. Obviously, you've got to repair the habitat and make it clean again for herring to come back and spawn. But again, there's evidence for how to do that and things to be careful about in the indigenous knowledge base. So those are two important things. And then, maybe the final thing that's important is really to take a systems view of herring, and not just in terms of ecosystems, but thinking about food systems more generally. We tend not to necessarily reflect on where our food comes from, how it's produced, and so on. But again, if you look at herring, it's just full of ironies about how, for example, when you take the sacro, you have to kill the herring, which the subsistence fishery doesn't. The subsistence fishery lets the herring spawn, and then the herring swims away to spawn again. But they used to actually take everything but the sacro, the rest of the fish in the commercial fishery, and just grind it up and push it back out as waste, which probably fed the crabs and the seagulls liked it. But now they're taking some of that, I don't know about all of it, but portions of it, shipping it to Asia, where it's manufactured into fish feed for farm salmon. So, maybe it's going to China, Vietnam, or whatever, it's being reprocessed and then coming back maybe to Norway, maybe to Chile, maybe to British Columbia to feed farm salmon that are competing with wild salmon for herring now, but also for the marketplace. And that's just crazy. And we obviously aren't calculating that carbon footprint, or even thinking about the real economics of that from the true meaning of economics, which is management of the house, right? Including all that we depend on. So I think taking that systems view of that is important as well, because one of the distinguished fisheries scientists from Peru has pointed out, we should be eating more herring in some ways, but not as an oil supplement in a capsule, but actually as the whole fish, or as the eggs that are renewable in the indigenous model, because they're lower on the food chain and you're capturing more of the energy and they can feed more people, and it can be done more sustainably than, say, farming salmon by feeding those herring to those salmon and all the other inputs, antibiotics and, water filtration, all that's necessary to keep those farms from falling into disaster. So I think that systems view is very important as well.
Yeah, it is ironic that the herring are being ground up into fish meal that is feeding carp in China as well, not just salmon, and pet food. You know, it's crazy that our herring from the Pacific Northwest are going to East Asia and feeding domesticated animals. And as Thomas said, promoting herring consumption locally and not exporting it would be a step forward because of their nutritional fatty acids. Because it's a wonderful superfood, both the eggs and the fish themselves. So promoting herring consumption locally, I think, is also a recommendation. But we have many more that you can read in the book.
There's so much in this book. You talk about the archaeological record. You talk about cultivation among the Tlingit and Haida of herring. You talk about what people are doing now. You talk about sacro fishing. There is a tradition on the New Books Network that I'd like to uphold, although we only have a few minutes, which is, what are you working on now?
Well, for me, one of the things I'm working on is adaptation to climate change. So that's been an area of interest in my career in the last 15 or 20 years. And it actually comes out of my work on the Northwest Coast, which has always been a dynamic environment, but one which has been inhabited for long periods of time by the same or similar peoples. That means that there's a good track record there of adaptation. Even herring eggs themselves, arguably the harvest is an adaptation that people developed to have an early spring food before salmon came into being. And transplanting and some of those other cultivation techniques could also be thought of in that way. But I'm interested in the, globally, we have to kind of adapt to environmental change. I mean, that's just an imperative. We can't mitigate it at all at this point. And so what do we as anthropologists and students of the long story of human development and the diverse story have to contribute to how people adapt to contemporary climate change, particularly in the 21st century and beyond?
I'm still working with herringbones. I'm working with colleagues at University of Washington and now University of British Columbia, Simon Fraser University, and we are attempting whole genome sequencing of herringbones, which has been done for Atlantic herring, but has so far not been done for Pacific herring, to work with the ancient material. So we're hoping with this, we're looking at two sites, one in Sitka Sound and one in the vicinity of Craig. And by that comparison geographically, trying to see if we can say more about genetic diversity in the past and how things have changed over time. Both sites are pre-contact. And so we're going to be hopefully getting a window into a period of time that we don't know much about. Ideally, we'd like to look at even Eleni Petru at Washington thinks that we can potentially use some new techniques to establish or a comparative population size, which would be very exciting. And the other project I'm working on involves sea otters. And while I have done some research in Southeast Alaska on people's use of sea otter, Tlingit people's use of sea otter, and looking at archaeological collections and trying to address the question whether or not people ate sea otter or if they just used their pelts. And I have a publication on that. I'm working with biologists at the University of New Mexico looking at isotopic data on ancient sea otter diet. Because with the sea otter expansion in Southeast Alaska, there's a conflict between sea otters and commercial fishermen who go for a lot of the same prey. So things like Dungeness crab, for example, is a pretty productive, lucrative fishery, but the sea otters love crab. They're also having an impact on some clam populations in some areas. So what we're looking at in ancient times is trying to see sea otter diet in the past and compare it to the future with the idea of providing information that's useful to managers today, to native people today, but also to assess the potential effects of introducing sea otters in places where they haven't been repatriated. So, for example, Places along the Washington state shoreline and also the Oregon coast are places where sea otters have been locally extirpated since the fur trade. And whether or not people want to reintroduce them is something that we hope will be a decision made with data that help people better understand the consequences of reintroducing sea otters into these waters. So those are two of the projects I'm working on at the moment.
The book is Herring and People of the North Pacific, published with the University of Washington Press. Professor Thornton, Professor Moss, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thank you for having us, Adam.